Federal Drive is presented by GEHA, Government Employees Health Association, proudly providing health and dental benefits to federal employees and their families. Visit GEHA.com.
Freedom of Information Act, or FOIA requests, keep rising every year. Some agencies have trouble responding to them on time, so backlogs grow. The Government Accountability Office finds the Justice Department bureau that oversees FOIA activity could improve its guidance on how to get out from under the backlogs. More now from the GAO's Director of Strategic Issues, Jay McTighe. Mr. McTighe, good to have you with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
And give us a sense of FOIA activity. Has it been on the rise? And tell us more about the level of backlogs some agencies, anyhow, are seeing.
Sure. We looked back over the last decade, looking at data from 2013 up through 2022, and we found that backlogs government-wide have nearly doubled to a little bit over 200,000 at the end of fiscal year 2022. You know, this reflects a long-term trend, a persistent challenge for federal agencies.
And simply, the public wants this information.
Absolutely. As you know, as you said, you know, FOIA is our nation's most important government transparency law. It gives the American public the statutory right to request government records. You know, all Americans have the right to know what their government is doing. So, you know, FOIA is central to government transparency.
And where do the backlogs tend to accumulate? These are not across the board evenly at all agencies, is it?
No, that's exactly right. So the Department of Homeland Security by far received the largest number of FOIA requests, accounting for about 60% of the government-wide total in fiscal year 2022. The Department of Homeland Security, together with the Departments of Justice, Defense, State, and Health and Human Services, together accounted for about 80% of all new requests. And as you said, the backlogs vary across the government, depending upon the agency. But overall, it's a big and growing problem.
And by backlog, that means those cases that have not been answered after 20 days, I think, is the statutory requirement.
That's right. FOIA generally requires agencies to respond to a request within 20 working days. And in their response, agencies should include a determination of the scope of the documents that they will provide and any exemptions that they claim, due to national security, personnel issues, or other information that they cannot provide to the public. Sometimes if there are unusual circumstances, an agency can extend that 20-day time frame for up to 10 working days, and the agency must also offer a requester the opportunity to limit the scope of the request or otherwise modify the request, again, to try to be responsive to the request.
And there's a few outlier cases sometimes that lay around for, I think the longest I ever heard of was 10 or 15 years. Sometimes they end up at the bottom of a pile.
Yeah, there are certainly cases like that. Most are not that bad. You know, we didn't look in great deal at specific requests during this audit. We were focused mainly on what agencies and what the Department of Justice is doing first to identify what the problems are with backlogs, you know, what are the root causes, and then what are agencies and DOJ doing to try to address the growing backlog? You know, it's clearly a problem.
We're speaking with Jay McTighe. He is the Director of Strategic Issues at the Government Accountability Office. And before we get to the root causes, tell us what Justice, that particular unit of Justice, what its job is in the whole FOIA area.
Yes, the Department of Justice oversees compliance with FOIA. Its Office of Information Policy helps agencies administer FOIA by providing guidance, training, and other resources to agencies. DOJ also oversees agencies' annual FOIA reporting requirements, which include plans for reducing backlogs, as well as information about, you know, the size of the backlog and how long it takes to process requests. And then finally, I should mention that OIP also manages the FOIA.gov website, which makes agencies' data available, their reports, and also provides information to the public about the FOIA process.
All right. And what did you find then with respect to their responsiveness to doing this and their knowledge of the actual causes? I think it might be staffing, it could be funding that they get for FOIA, it could be the complexity of the cases. I mean, there's a lot of variables.
There are a lot of variables, a lot of factors that go into this. And so what we did is, I mentioned the annual Chief FOIA Officer reports that are on the FOIA.gov website. We looked at the last 5 years of those reports and teased out what the key issues were. We also had focus groups with the 24 CFO Act agencies, you know, to get a little bit more granular detail about what's going on in the FOIA process. And so, yes, as you mentioned, staffing was one that came up quite often, as well as the increased scope and complexity of FOIA requests. And then, you know, other frequently cited issues included coordination across agencies, different offices and other units, you know, for some of the very broad requests. Litigation is something that has come up quite a bit lately. And then finally, technology. A lot of agencies are struggling acquiring technology to search records, but also technology has kind of made the retention and types of communication bigger and a little bit more challenging to deal with. You know, back in the day when FOIA was enacted into law, a lot of information was on paper. Nowadays, you know, you have all kinds of electronic communication. You have emails, you have instant messaging, you have text messaging, and so on and so forth. And that has generated just massive volumes of information that has to be searched. And it can take time, especially without the proper technology tools.
And you had a list of recommendations for the Justice Department and the Office of Information Policy. Highlight them for us.
As I mentioned, you know, backlogs have become a persistent and growing problem. The Department of Justice has taken steps to require certain agencies, those agencies with over 1,000 backlog requests, to develop, you know, actionable plans to reduce the backlogs. But what we found is that OIP could improve the guidance to agencies in regard to these plans, because currently in its guidance, it doesn't specify elements that should be included in these plans. And these are pretty basic elements, but really the cornerstone of effective plans, such as goals, performance measures, timeframes for implementing specific actions, and including that kind of information could really help make plans much more robust and actionable. You know, we did look at the 14 agencies that were directed by OIP to come up with plans, and only two of those agencies included specific goals, and only one included, you know, any kind of performance metric. And, you know, very few, actually none, included timelines for implementing the actions that they were going to take. So we had two recommendations to improve guidance on plans. And we also had two additional recommendations focused on the information that is reported to OIP on backlogs and the time it takes for agencies to respond to requesters. And there was some confusion in how agencies calculated some of that information. And, you know, without good data, it's hard to get a good handle on the issues. So OIP, the Department of Justice, agreed with all four of our recommendations and has already started drafting new guidance to include the information that we suggested and clarify both the information and training on providing some of the data in the FOIA reports that I mentioned.
So maybe we'll see some cleanup of those attics or basements, I don't know, depending on what you think of FOIA, wherever you stash them away. Jay McTighe is Director of Strategic Issues at the Government Accountability Office. Thanks so much.
Thanks again, Tom.
We'll post this interview along with a link to his report at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Hear the Federal Drive on demand. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Leadership today, especially within the federal workforce, is being tested more than ever before. As the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency's Chief People Officer, Elizabeth Comstetter sees a focus on people as absolutely crucial to her leadership style. Comstetter joined Shane Canfield, WEPA CEO, to reflect on her years of experience leading in the federal human capital space.
Hello, and welcome to the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I'm your host, Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. Today I'm joined by Dr. Elizabeth Comstetter, Chief People Officer at the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
In your current position at CISA, one of your responsibilities is ensuring a people-first culture. Explain what that is, and what's the role of leadership in creating and shaping that culture?
Yes, at CISA, really paramount to our culture is a people-first driven aspect, so that we are really looking at how do we accomplish our mission through our people. And in order to do that, we really value our people. We want them to feel empowered and supported and respected, and also that their managers care about them. So well-being is important. Psychological safety in the workplace is important, so that all voices and ideas are heard. So I like to call it our North Star. Having a people-first culture really starts with the people in order to get our incredibly difficult mission accomplished. In terms of leadership, which is a great question, I think we all know that culture is really driven by leadership and the behaviors that we allow and we reinforce in our leaders. So we really work at making sure that our leaders are bringing out the best in their people every day. So again, that they feel they can bring their voice, especially an opinion that might not go along with the majority of a group, so that we get that diverse perspective. We get those different ideas and experiences. And that's really where we find that it's important that leaders are purposefully bringing out their talent on their teams to enable our mission.
Yeah, excellent. We're going through a culture project at our work.
Oh, great.
Yeah, it's been 6 months in the making, and it's going really well, but it is work.
Yes.
And it requires from the top down. So I'm also involved in that. I hear you.
Great.
Throughout your career, you've piloted many different talent management programs, including at NASA, the CIA, the FBI, just to name a few, and you have an amazing career. What have you learned, or how have you might have changed along the way in creating and leading those programs?
Yes, and I am so honored to have had a career in public service across multiple federal agencies, always in the realm of human resources and workforce performance. And I think because I study organizations and people in them, I've come to realize, particularly in the federal government, that many of our programs are really grounded in the industrial era thinking, that this is organizationally structured in a hierarchy with boxes and lines on charts, with the center being around jobs and what do we need to get this job done in terms of skills and training. And what I found is that we're really not in the industrial era anymore, where we would promote the smartest people who knew that work, and they would then tell the people on their team how to do things and oversee that work. We're now in a digital era and the information era, where work gets done collaboratively across geographic boundaries and certainly across org charts. So we like to call it networks or hierarchies, and we really need to, again, unleash people so they can find those other people who are working on similar problems or have the right ideas. And so I really like to think of our work now in the talent programs being human-centered. It's more about the user and the experience than about the rules and regulations. So although we have to have rules and regulations, certainly in human resources, is that person experiencing what they need and getting what they need for their role at that time? So not so much on the job, but on the person. So for example, we're recruiting. What's the applicant experiencing? Because if they're not having a good experience with our organization from the time we're recruiting them, they're going to go work for somebody else. Same thing with like first-time supervisors. We know they need certain training, but telling them to sit in a class for 1 week and then hope a year from now they'll remember what they learned to apply, that's not really human-centered. The human-centered is what do they need when they need it, and building modules or just-in-time training and bringing that to the people, to that user, as they need it. So that's really, I think, the most important focus of talent programs today in this era to enable the workers to be the best they can be in their roles.
Excellent. New thinking. This is always an interesting question. Has there been a time when, as a leader, that you've made a mistake? And what is that? And I think most important, what did you take away from that? What did you learn from that?
Well, I kind of chuckle because I think as leaders, we have to learn to recognize our mistakes, admit our mistakes, and that they are opportunities to learn. And so I've had to do my own self-reflection on on making mistakes and when things don't turn out the way that I expected them to. Makes me think of a time when I was at the Transportation Security Administration and I was a supervisor. And I was really embroiled with my program. I was the technical leader of it. I understood it. I'd run it for years. And I was making a briefing for a decision that had to be made about this program that was very near and dear to me. And I presented the briefing to one of the very senior people in the agency. And I think there are about 20 people in the room. And I had gone through the briefing, answered all the questions. And that leader then said, okay, I'm going to go around the room and get everybody's opinion. And then everybody gets to vote, which kind of set me aback because there were people in that room that didn't have any technical knowledge about my program. She even turned to the executive assistant there taking notes on the meeting and said, go ahead and I want to hear from you. And I realized in hindsight, I had stopped listening. I had been in transmitting all of my knowledge and what I saw to be the right way. And I was not listening to different perspectives in the room because I didn't think that I didn't value that they were bringing any kind of input to this particular decision. And it didn't go as I had hoped. And I left very disappointed and was busy blaming the senior leader and how that meeting was conducted, that she let all these people have opinions when they didn't know, in my mind, didn't know what they were talking about. And so in reflection on that, I realize, and now as I've moved into more senior leadership positions, I realize that was a mistake, that it actually is really important to listen, especially to people who have different perspectives or at a different point in the career, not just the people who know the program or the technical really well. And so that was a mistake I made, and I realized in my own sense I wasn't listening to very different opinions, and I probably should have because I would have learned more about what was needed for this program going forward than just leaving, getting upset that it didn't go a certain way. So I've really practiced active listening. I've practiced making sure there's very different people on teams and certainly on committees or councils, that we need early careers, people new to the agency, people who haven't walked in the shoes of the technical workforce, because they're asking questions we need to hear for these programs to be successful.
Excellent. Your career in talent management means your work is very closely tied to people. And even your title, Chief People Officer, what does that mean to you to be a leader in the federal system with that focus?
Isn't that a great title? I just love the title Chief People Officer, and I think it's my dream job, really, to be focused on people and culture and the workforce strategy for the whole agency. And I'm just so excited to be at CISA at this point in time. We're only 4 years young as an agency, so we're really still creating who we're going to become as an agency and what is our culture and what kind of people and talent do we need to be sure we have to be successful. So it's very exciting for me to be in this role with a intentional focus on culture. Because it's one of those things, if you leave it to chance and you kind of hope it goes the way you want it to, it probably won't. So by building programs, including leadership development programs, including any kind of training and learning and career growth and engagement programs and listening programs, that's what's really key for, I think, for our agency and particularly me in this role. I think in the federal government, we got used to doing annual survey, the Federal Employee Viewpoint Survey that OPM, Office of Personnel Management, runs every year. So we would do a survey and we'd read it and we'd say, oh, this is the opinion of our people. And then we would do action plans and then we'd roll out certain activities that we would hope would increase engagement. In this era, you can't do once a year and understand what your employees' experiences are, what they need, what's working well, and what needs to improve. We need active, ongoing listening programs. So one of the things we're doing at CISA is having more pulse surveys, having more focus groups and what we call sensing sessions, expecting our leaders to have office hours where anybody can come and just talk about what's going well, what do they need, how are things going? Because we feel like it is an ongoing need to hear from our people. And I think in this role and over the years of serving, I've also realized there's never a one-size-fits-all. You know, we think certain people need certain things at certain times in their career. There's no one-size-fits-all. neither can we also customize everything to every individual. So there's got to be a sweet spot in building really great talent programs, but also, like I said, thinking about, can we do this in modules? Can we make it a menu? Can we do it just in time as people need it so they can practice the new skill or knowledge in their role? So I think we have such great opportunity, again, with the technology that enables us to really focus on how we connect people with their work and their team to get things done in very new ways.
This is always an interesting question. Is there a figure, either from your personal life, your past, somewhere in history generally, that inspired you, your leadership style, how you view leadership?
There are many figures who have been very inspirational to me, but there is one that sticks out, and that's my mother, Paula Brownlee, who has been a very inspiring leader to me all my life. And I think because, first and foremost, she had a strong family and a strong career, and that's something I always wanted. And I saw her first as my mother, but then I also saw her as a leader in her career and in academia, which was her chosen field. But I always knew her family came first. And as I saw how she balanced different family needs with also a growing and more prominent career positions in leadership, that she had to balance that. And I think I learned from her that you can have both. You have to focus on different things through your career and through your life, but that you don't have to trade one for the other. I've been married, happily married, for 32 years, and I'm a mother of twins who are almost 24 years old. So, and I've had a great career in public service. So I think that having her as a role model has really helped me find my own courage, find my own confidence, and find my own voice in how I can prioritize the things that are most important to me so that I can actually balance both family and career.
And you're doing it well. Thank you. Having known you now for 7 or 8 years, yeah, and worked alongside you, your passion is infectious.
Thank you.
Your intelligence and the thoughtfulness with which you approach all of these issues, it's an honor for you to be here, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
I'm Shane Canfield, CEO at WEPA, and until next time, have a great day.
Find the full podcast and future episodes of Lessons in Leadership on the Federal News Network app and anywhere you enjoy your podcasts.